Hi, everybody. Welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. It's good to have you here with us. I'm back from Solheim Cup, Oktoberfest, and the Ryder Cup. I want to talk about Solheim Cup and Ryder Cup a little bit through the first two-thirds of the show, and then talk about the experience of just being in Europe for a little bit with my wife. And then at the back end of this, we will have an interview, 10 minutes or so, with Peter Jacobson, who is the chairman of the new World Champions Cup. It's a three-team competition, Team USA, Team International, Team Europe, featuring players from the Champions Tour. Starts in December, kind of starting to make some bigger announcements about it. So we talked with Peter today about the competition, and we'll have that as kind of the last 10 minutes of the show. You get a hold of me on Twitter, X, Instagram, Threads, at Ryan Ballingy. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Happy to talk golf, life with you. I very much appreciate you listening to the show this week. So let's start Solheim Cup. And this was the first Solheim Cup that I had ever been to. I'm embarrassed to say I'd never been one in the United States. But when I knew that the Solheim Cup and the Ryder Cup would be played not too far apart on the same continent, 1 week apart, I knew I had to be there. And I also knew I had to take my wife. So we created this this trek that we were going to do. We were going to fly to Madrid to go see our friends in Spain. They live in Madrid, one of my wife's friends from college and her husband and their children. And then we were going to go to Andalusia, Malaga, by train, and then go see the Solheim Cup. So we wound up going for 2 days of competition. So we went Friday and Saturday because we flew in, left the United States Wednesday, got to Madrid on Thursday, did Madrid on Thursday, and took the train down on Friday. And it was a really cool experience being on the golf course to watch some tremendous match play team golf. The Europeans were great. I really loved I really loved the spirit the Europeans had. Not just the players, but the fans. I tweeted out a fan ranking of just kind of for laughs. But it was really cool to see the fan base for this event because it is different than the Ryder Cup. The Solheim Cup fan base is, for one, obviously people who love women's golf. Two, there are many more women in attendance at the Solheim Cup. Lots of young girls who are playing golf. They were walking around with their, you know, team golf hats and shirts, whether they were from like a Spanish golf federation or a local golf federation, whether they were just young players who liked a particular player, you know, whatever. Older fans too. The Swedes were great. I mean, they were great at the Ryder Cup too. They're really a lot of fun, very friendly to talk to. Really enjoyed spending some time with them. I had a great time. I mean, there were lots of kind of 40 to 50 to 60-year-old British women who were there on like a girls' weekend. Like four or five or six of them were there as a group, and maybe they played some golf in the Costa del Sol, Malaga area. The town in which we stayed, our hotel is called Estepona. And we saw so many of those different groups. They were so witty and fun. It was great. The player passion was awesome. I loved what it meant to the European players. They really got into it. And I think that they knew they had an incredible opportunity in front of them to win three times in a row. And they, after the first session, didn't get down on themselves. Because they lost the first session 4-0. And my wife and I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe we're actually going to see this thing happen on the road. The Americans are going to dominate on the road. And then the Europeans started to just chip away. And in the final, really 23 matches, they found the 14 points that they needed to win. Or at least retain the cup via tie. Ties are very rare in either Solheim Cup or Ryder Cup. This was the, 19th Solheim Cup, 44th Ryder Cup. We haven't had many ties. And the American side, I think, was really into it as well. Fair number of American fans, not nearly the same number as you would expect at a Ryder Cup. Like, the difference going to out of the Malaga airport, because we went to the Malaga train station from Madrid, but flew out of the airport because we went to Munich. The difference in the number of Americans that were walking around with Solheim Cup gear on versus the number of Americans coming in and out of the FCO airport in Rome for the Ryder Cup was stark. But the American support was cool. It was interesting. The European fans were great because they, I think, appreciated that American fans were willing to travel for it. There were a lot of complaints about the venue, and I was one of the people that complained about it privately. Didn't talk about it too much publicly the week of, because, frankly, logistics are hard, but the way Costa del Sol's kind of set up is very interesting. It's completely different than how I've ever experienced really any resort or beach area in the United States, where there's kind of a main highway that kind of runs down Costa del Sol. So from Malaga City, which was fantastic, all the way down 150 kilometers kind of thing, almost 100 miles, just two-lane road, high-speed road, and on both sides, but particularly the coastal side, is just resort after hotel after all jammed in, condos, housing, all jammed in. You get off, and then you kind of weave your way through a couple of traffic circles, and you get to your particular artery, and you're at your resort. So getting in and out of Finca Cortesine, which is a luxury development up on top of a hill on the other side. It's not on the beach side, but on the other side. It was tricky because a variety of different decisions were made. One, the busing in and out was not bad. It was just not enough of it. And so it created very large lines of people trying to get in and out. The bus schedules were kind of weird because they had a drop-off schedule and then an intervening few hours and then a pickup schedule. So once you were there, you couldn't just get off and get back on and go back. Like if you needed that. If you got off, you were there until 1 o'clock in the afternoon when the return buses started. And that made for tricky transportation choices for everybody. And the other part of it was that they had one taxi cab ride share service. It was this app called Move Transfer. And the benefit of using Move Transfer was that they were only the only company authorized to have drivers come up right to the gate, drop you off, pick you up. Problem was, app didn't really work. It was overloaded, and there weren't enough drivers, there weren't enough taxis, there weren't enough people doing rides to and from the event. So getting a taxi through Move Transfer was borderline impossible. Both times we used it, we had to get manual intervention from the good folks who were trying to make it work. And they were very nice and tried very hard to make it work. And ultimately, four or five of us got into a van and they took us to multiple different stops. And that's just how they did it. But it wasn't particularly helpful for trying to shuttle hundreds, if not 1,000 fans from the venue to where they needed to be, where they were staying. So that was kind of rough. Walking around Finca Cortesine was a task. The way the venue's set up, it's not a walking golf course. I mean, the landscape of Costa del Sol is beach leading up, like where desert beach meets beach. Very mountainous, very rugged terrain from which a lot of golf courses are carved. I mean, there's something like 70 golf courses in Costa del Sol, so kind of like Myrtle Beach in that regard. But Finca Cortesine's grade is very difficult from a walking standpoint. If you're walking the cart paths and the side hills and all of that stuff, the playing areas were fine. The players probably weren't as exhausted as the fans were. Still lots of hills to negotiate, a lot of climb down and up and down and around. particularly once you get to the middle of the back nine, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Big climb up, then climb down, then climb up. So it could be an exhausting venue, and it kind of made it difficult to get around. It made it difficult for fans to get around because there were a lot of arteries that were clogged by players moving in front or behind, and then the fans had to wait for those players to make a significant journey along those arteries to get to the next part of their round, whether that was tee to fairway or whatever, green to tee. So that made it tricky. And then the first day was a debacle in terms of just getting food and services to people. They ran out of a lot of food items, ran out of some other beverages. I mean, it was a problem. Got better on day two, got better on day three. And then it sounds like the TV coverage was not great. Golf Channel openly complained about it on the air. Not getting access to shots from matches. Whole matches, by the way. Again, 16 golfers on the course at any one time on Friday and Saturday. On Sunday, 24 golfers max on the course, and that was very rare. And some matches were just completely left off of the broadcast. And that's a point of contention that hopefully will get very much fixed for next year here in the Northern Virginia area. But the golf itself was awesome. It was really cool to watch. Finca Courtesy is a difficult golf course in terms of putting. It's difficult to score upon because there are a lot of kind of blind shots. But the players, tee to green, played really well. Just not a lot of putts fell. And that made Friday and Saturday a little bit trickier. But Saturday, you could kind of smell the European comeback happening. And it started to seem very apparent that the Europeans had all the mo. And then you got to Sunday, and you had a really dramatic, wonderful finish where players went out and got points. There was kind of an even split of the big matches at the top of the card. Leona Maguire handled Rose Zhang, but then Megan Kang went out and got Lynn Grant from the opening match, which I was kind of surprised about, thought it would maybe go the other way. And it seemed like the Americans had a real opportunity with about an hour to go to win this thing on the road still. And yet you had Carlotta Segonda, who overcame a cold shank, I think of the 15th hole, won 16 and 17 to secure the tying point. And then you had, before that, Caroline Hedwall, who I believe was three down and won, what, the last five holes to win the match or something? I mean, something outrageous to come back and get a point. And the celebration was probably a little over the top for a tie, but you also knew the rules ahead of time. You knew the Europeans had won the cup, and that was worth, therefore, a half-point advantage in whether you won or not. And the celebration was really interesting, very cool. For Carlotta Segonda to be able to have clinched the securing point, the retaining point, in home soil, playing a great week. I mean, she's a really tough match player. I mean, she's a slower player, very methodical. That makes it hard for match play. She's also just really good in this format, which is the most important part. Leona Maguire was incredible. I mean, she is truly built for this kind of thing. It's almost kind of shocking she doesn't win more given that, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. In the pressure of match play, the importance of tee to green golf versus putting is so stark. It's frankly a different game. And Emily Peterson was great. She had a hole in one on, what was it, Saturday? Or Friday. And just played out of her mind golf-wise. I mean, she was one of the captain's picks from Suzanne Pedersen. I did not anticipate her playing all that well, but she was one of the horses they rode. And Lynn Grant was obviously a part of it too. And they really had four players that did the bulk of the work. And that's what you need in one of these team competitions. You need three, four, five horses. You don't even need half the team. You need like three or four, really, but you need probably five is ideal. Horses that you can just ride, and they get you 95% of your points, 90% of your points. And then in the singles competition, you hope to get lucky and one or two of the other players show up and get you a point, or do enough to get half points cobbled together to mean something, mean a win. And that was the strategy Suzanne Pedersen employed. She knew what she didn't have, and she knew what she had. And I thought she did a great job using that. Even though she went with her gut, she didn't go with the numbers. She's not a numbers person, and that was very evident in how she made choices about her teams. She just kind of went with what she felt worked, and she knew who she was going to ride and rode them. And Charlie Hall wasn't at 100% health, so that kind of impacted her strategy. Caroline Hedwall wasn't playing at 100%. That impacted her strategy. I think still part of being a good captain is knowing how to understand what you have, not only overall, but that week. You need to know how well your players are playing, how comfortable they are. Are they sick? Are they ill? Are they injured? What can they contribute? Getting the best out of them. Knowing who can give you their best consistently and playing that until you win. There's nothing to be nice about. There's no participation trophy for each individual based on the number of matches they play. If you're on the winning side, you win all the same. It doesn't matter whether you played once or you played five times. You were a winner. And Suzanne came up with a great strategy for that. I thought Stacey Lewis did a generally good job with her team. They obviously did not play up to their standard after the first session. They got 10 points the rest of the way in the final 24 matches. That's not good enough. They should have won. But I think there were some bright spots. Rose Zhang was awesome. Megan Kang, I love watching her play match play. Lexi Thompson was a bright spot. There were a lot of questions about her participation because this is her worst season as a pro. And she had a good finish last week in Arkansas. She's trying to save her card while also being in the top 25 in the world. It's a really weird dynamic there. But she went and got 3 points and went 3-1. And the one that she lost, she embarrassed herself in how she answered the questions about the chip that she had on 18. She got home basically in 2, pin high on a par 5. And really, even if the lie wasn't that good, she still shanked the chip shot and said at first she didn't have to answer a question about that. And Stacey Lewis then called it a horrible question, which I know she's got her players back and what she's trying to do in that situation, but that's not a horrible question. That is the question. And ultimately, Lexi then just said the lie was impossible. I wasn't going to be able to get up and down. And I don't think that was really true either. Obviously, I didn't have two eyes on it. I was on the other side of the green watching the match unfold. But I still think that moment, that whole reaction took away from what was ultimately a great contribution all week to the American team. She did a great job. And Allison Corpuz, I think, is going to be a great player in this format for a long time to come. And I thought Cheyenne Knight was a bright spot. She didn't lose. Angel Yin is awesome. I feel like anytime people with a bigger, when the LPGA gets a bigger audience and they get to watch Angel Yin, she gets more fans by the day. So I hope, compared to like 2017, that this is a longer lasting run for her because she is really entertaining, really fun to watch, and just an enjoyable personality. And so we get that matchup. At least Stacey Lewis is captain. I assume Suzanne Pedersen will be back, but I don't know. Next year at Robert Trent Jones Golf Club here in the D.C. area. For everyone who was worried about logistics and TV coverage, this was kind of an aberration. IMG, the International Management Group, ran the 19 event, and they did a great job for Europe. And for whatever reason, they didn't do it this time. Basically, a Spanish government body ran it and didn't do a good job. They don't run golf tournaments. They didn't really know what they were getting into. And they did the best that they could. And the television stuff didn't go very well. And that'll get cleaned up. IMG's back for the next road, Solheim Cup, which will be in the Netherlands. And it'll all work itself out. It's a great event. If you are in this country, if you're in the United States, and you haven't been to a Solheim Cup, first of all, come on down. Come on out. Happy to buy you a beer. Track me down. I'll be an unofficial ambassador, mascot, whatever, for 2024. It's going to be a special week for this area. RTJ is a pretty fun golf course. Should be a good match play golf course. And it should offer very good logistics getting in and getting out of the area. And I know that the LPGA was kind of worried that this might leave a sour taste in some people's mouths. It shouldn't. It was still a great competition and really, really enjoyable. And I really liked the Malaga area. We'll talk about that in the third segment, I suppose. But as far as travel goes, I really enjoyed Spain. Didn't get enough time there, frankly. I mean, there's so much to explore in Spain, but at least the part that we got to see was great. All right, let's go ahead and take a quick little break. We'll be right back after this. All right, welcome back to the show, everybody. Let's get into the Ryder Cup. There's a lot of fallout from everything, and I think there are some longer-term things to talk about. There's shorter-term drama, of course, to talk about, and we can kind of go all kinds of different directions with this. We can do a whole show just about the Ryder Cup, but I don't think it merits it, but it's kind of time to move on. I think I want to start with the longer-term trend line around the Ryder Cup from a couple of different perspectives. One, the score is not close. It has not been close for five Ryder Cups going back to 2014. And really, if the United States side had not sleptwalked through the single Sunday in 2012, perhaps at the intervention of Seve Ballesteros, it would have been six straight Ryder Cups that weren't all that close. The last genuinely close one that should not have been a blowout was 2010. And that was Celtic Manor, that's Graham McDowell, that's him finishing it off, that's Hunter Mahan coming up short, finishes on Monday. That was incredible. Truly one of the best Ryder Cups. And ever since, we really haven't had a genuinely good one. They've just been home blowouts. And 2012, obviously, unique because of the European comeback. But that was a blowout up until the last hour of Saturday, and then it all turned. And frankly, some revelations in Billy Walter's book, particularly about Phil Mickelson, make you wonder a little bit about that Saturday afternoon. But nevertheless, the Ryder Cup has not been particularly dramatic on Sunday for the better part of a decade, more than a decade. So the reality is the home field advantage that both sides have managed to create, whether that's through course setup, whether that's through having partisan fans on your side, very much on your side. I think that was never more evident than in 2021 because of the travel restrictions. My wife and I would talk to some folks from Sweden at Marco Simone, and the one guy's like a Packers fan. He's like, I really wanted to get over to Whistling Straits. We had tickets to a Packers game. We had this lineup. We were going to be in Chicago. We were going to play golf here. We were going to go to the Ryder Cup. It was going to be great. And we couldn't get clearance to come into the United States because of COVID. And that happened to a lot of people. So there was an overwhelming number, even more than usual, of American fans in a ratio to European fans. And I think that meant a whole heck of a lot. Other circumstances there in 21, aging team, infighting, but predominantly an aging team that was just kind of out of their prime. It was time to move on. That led to a 10-point loss. But the setup also played a huge factor. The Americans set up to the strengths of their players, which is driving the ball and hitting wedges. The opposite happened at Marco Simone. The Europeans knew the Americans drive the ball far with a cut, and they hit a lot of wedges. And so what they did was set up the golf course so the opening holes favored a draw. One did, two did, three did, four and five were essentially par threes, even the five was a par four. Six was the first hole that was a benefit to the Americans because everyone just laid up to a wedge number. And that was a hole actually we spent a fair amount of time watching. Americans consistently won that hole in team play because it was a wedge. Wedge to a short distance, make a putt. That's easy golf. That favors the Americans. And so that was a bone thrown to them after five holes of uncomfortable golf. And the Europeans knew they could set up the golf course to favor their strengths, which was driving with a draw, although many of their players hit a cut, but they felt comfortable and took less than off the tee if they didn't feel comfortable. And also leaving approach shots for the Americans as long as possible, really, but more in the 175-yard range. take the wedge out of their hand, take the 9-iron out of their hand, make them hit an 8-iron, 7-iron, 6-iron, whatever. I mean, from 175 yards, a lot of pros are hitting 8-iron now. But make them hit something just a little bit longer and take them out of their comfort zone. And the brilliant strategy worked. The Europeans crushed it on the opening hole. When they won the opening hole, they won the match like 70% of the time. If you won the first six holes, you won pretty much all the time. That's how you set it up to your advantage. It's not that the rough had to be long. It was that the course, the holes were at the right lengths and left the right shots for their players to be successful. And that advantage is so huge, those two things, course setup and partisan fans. Because really, in no other part of golf are there 30 to 50,000 people rooting against you at any one time. There might be people who don't like you, might shout mean things at you, stuff like that, and I understand. But never on the scale of the Ryder Cup. And I don't care how many times you play it, you never, ever get used to that. And it frankly makes the players in the NBA, for example, you know, Jordan's, LeBron's, Jimmy Butler's, got me going on the line of great playoff players who go on the road and hear the most vile stuff said to them by 20,000 people in fairly close proximity, as close as golf proximity, and still kicked everyone's ass. That makes that much more impressive to me. Max Homa was talking about to his caddy after he had made the putt on 18 to win his point on Sunday. He said he couldn't feel his legs. Couldn't feel his legs when he was putting. Thought that was an incredible admission of what it really feels like to have that many people rooting against you, pulling for you to fail. That's a huge motivator. That is a huge advantage. I think the advantage of home field, so to speak, is worth 2 to 3 points in this format. And 2 to 3 points isn't 2 to 3 points. It's double that, because that's 2 to 3 points the other side can't get. So it's borders from 4 to 6 points. These teams are fairly even, but the ability to set up your course how you want and the ability to have partisan fans rooting against your opponent on a scale they've never experienced probably before, most of them will never experience again, is worth that much. And that's why we've got a series now that frankly isn't anywhere close and has structural problems. And that's reflected in the viewership numbers. So we talked about this on my daily podcast, Two of the First, but the viewership numbers have gone down consistently from 2010 to the point where this year, on Sunday, Sunday's typically the best watch day for the Ryder Cup. That was the second best day. They had a loss of audience from 1.4 million on Saturday to 1.3 million on Sunday. Yes, I know everyone knew it was a blowout. I knew everyone knew that the Americans couldn't win from that 5-point margin, or at least had never been done from that 5-point margin. And so they probably became disinterested. But having that kind of obvious blowout where Sunday doesn't really matter, that's the long-term problem for this thing. Obviously, Tiger not playing doesn't help. That's part of it. I don't think it's a huge part of it, because if you look at 2014 versus 2018, the ratings difference isn't that substantial. Tiger didn't play in 14, did play in 18. I think a couple of things are at work. One, this isn't as dramatic as it used to be, and people realize it now. Two, I think a lot of people are turned off by the money in golf, and the whole thing about Patrick Cantlay and the not wearing the hat tweet from Jamie Weir, and he and Xander Schauffele wanting to play for money, and that being public, even though it was denied, but it was true. The hat part probably wasn't true, but the rest of it was. I'm sure that turned some people off. The commercial load is terrible. You're basically just watching commercials with golf interspersed. That's not a good viewing experience. And all of that combines to create a long-term problem for this competition where you go, all right, well, now what do you do? How do you make it better? And I think there's a lot of things to try to attack about it. I don't know how much of it gets addressed, to be honest. I don't think you change how it works. I don't think we're going to have 4 days. There's not going to be a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I think the President's Cup gets that right more than the Ryder Cup does. I think 4 days better than three, to be honest with you. But that's not going to change. Course setup thing is not going to change. I don't think anytime soon. I don't think, because of the rates fees involved, the commercial load's going to change. So none of this is getting better anytime soon, unless there's some kind of market change in the quality of the competition on either side. Like Europe starts to stink and the U.S. gets better, or whatever. I don't know. They're pretty even teams. But there's been some thought about the selection process changing, having six captains picks. Well, that worked out brilliantly at Whistling Straits. It worked out terribly this time. But also, the automatic qualifiers were terrible. So for all the people like, well, you got to go back to, you know, eight qualifiers and four captains picks, or 10 qualifiers and two captains picks. The team would have been fundamentally the same had you done it those ways. And those players were all stinky. There is no team formation difference that you can have if everyone who was going to be on it anyway stunk, with the noted exceptions of Patrick Cantlay, who played very well, and for as much as I don't like him personally for a variety of reasons, he played well. And Max Homa was incredible. Truly a guy who really seemed to embrace this thing. It was great, and I very much appreciate that. But I just don't see it changing. And I don't see the quality of the competition changing. The home field advantage thing is huge. I know the Europeans love to make a whole lot of their culture, and it can almost borderline on cult around Seve. But they play for each other. They play for the past, the present, and the future of the competition. They buy in on it. They don't care about the money for a variety of reasons. One of the biggest knowing that the proceeds from the Ryder Cup, particularly the European Ryder Cups, keep the DP World Tour afloat. Literally keeps it afloat for 4 years. That's how big and important it is. That's why they don't want a dime from it, because they see the benefit. They see the importance of the future coming from that system. And that's why there's never any discussion about that from their side. But the other thing that I think they do extremely well is they, for 1 week, the best players on their team this week was Hovland, Rahm, and McIlroy. They treat the lesser players, they're not worse or whatever, they're just lesser in terms of quality of player. They treat them like equals, and they lift them up for a week. And that may change the day they're done. They go back to being individuals. But for 3 days of competition and the days leading into it, they are all treated on the same level, as they are all the best in the world, and they all function together, and they all win together, and they all lose together. And I think they do that extremely well. The United States does not. The United States' version of this is a buddy system, where you have one or two friends that you play with, and if you do well, it looks brilliant. It used to be the pod system. Pod systems now devolved in the buddy system. And if they don't play well, it all falls apart, because you go, oh, well, I'm buddies with so-and-so, I'm going to play with them. Well, if you both stink and then you got to break up the pairing, everyone gets all worried about it. Instead of just saying, look, here's backup option B. I thought one of the most telling matches of the entire thing was Sam Burns and Colin Morikawa. Two guys I don't think I would pair together, went out there, probably because Zach Johnson asked for some people who would just give a shit, and they went out there and won their match easily. It was a four-ball match, I understand, but they went out there and got their point. They did their job, and I think Justin Rose made a very salient point while he was trying to kind of make a cut at the Americans and say, the best pairings aren't your best friends, necessarily. And the Europeans don't necessarily pair players based on friendships or relationships. They pair players because of a variety of other reasons that could work. Shared golf ball, shared style, could be friendship, could be statistically complementary, could be any of those things, all of those things. But they have different reasons, different prisms through which they view partnership. Versus the Americans just go, I like that guy and I'm going to play with him. That's why Sam Burns is on the team. Sam Burns was not playing well. He's overmatched for that particular week. That doesn't mean he won't be better the next time, but this time he wasn't any good. And the reality is that home course advantage and setup have a lot to do with it. Then the next biggest factor is did your guys come to play golf? Were you good enough? And we have not had a Ryder Cup in 15 years, really, 12 years, where the answer is yes for both sides. And obviously those prior factors set up and home course advantage affect that outcome. So I don't know what you change. I don't know what you make better. But we are in an era in the Ryder Cup where it's overhyped for the result. It's overexposed because there's too much commercial coverage. And both sides have kind of dug themselves in on how they approach this. Meanwhile, you've got Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay, through Stefan Schauffele, openly admitting that they didn't really want to play because they didn't want to agree to the PGA of America's rules around a lack of compensation, around granting access to full swing to the team room, because they wanted to know who's getting rich off them. Because the PGA of America makes a ton of money off this thing. They do. That's not new. They have a huge television contract with NBC. They get lots of sponsorship stuff. This is a big deal for them. It just is. But the players don't see any tangible benefit from it other than a $200,000 donation to the charity of their choice, which, by the way, led to the creation of the Payne Stewart Foundation, a bunch of other player name foundations back in 1999, because that was how they wanted to do it. Instead of just giving the money to, like, the Boys and Girls Club or something, it was like, well, I want to control the money, so I'm going to start my own foundation. You give it to my foundation. And then I can hire my own board of directors and effectively pay people who I want. Whatever. But if you bring money into this, and I think this is an interesting conversation I had with James Corrigan the other day on Twitter or X. Problem is, if you bring money into it for the American side, you have to bring it in for the European side. If you bring it in for the European side, the matches end because it kills the European tour. At least as we understand it with everything structured the way that it is now. Because, again, going back to this thing making the DP World Tour for 4 years. Now, if things change and there's an agreement with the Saudis, or the Saudis don't even have to be involved, it could be other capital, and the PGA Tour acquires the DP World Tour, and now the PGA Tour owns the DP World Tour's piece, which is the biggest chunk, 75% I think it is, of Ryder Cup Europe. Well, now they can go, okay, well, maybe we'll want to own the whole thing. We buy out the PGA of America piece. It's going to be quite expensive, but they can do it. Or they can go and say, we will pay players for both sides because now we have an interest in it. We've stopgapped, backstopped the DP World Tour. Could happen that way. I think that could be an interesting way to player compensation. And I don't think that it is necessarily wrong for players on either side to wonder why they're not being directly compensated for participating. At the same time, I also think you are being compensated. Winning captains make an enormous amount of money off of speaking engagements and other opportunities because they were a winning captain. Players, not so much. But a lot of European players made themselves quite a bit of money because they were great Ryder Cup players and not necessarily great individual players. But for Schauffele and Cantlay, who are very clearly were interested in going to live, who very clearly courted them, who very clearly have put the dollar in front of everything that the PGA Tour does, and maybe rightfully so, it just tarnishes this competition. And I don't know the best way to handle it. I don't think compensation really is the angle, but I don't know where that goes either. And it just seemed to kind of sour a lot of people on various facets of this. But I do want to bring it back to the actual competitive piece of this before we wrap up this segment. The thing I found most interesting about Solheim Cup and Ryder Cup and team match play, just match play in general, it is completely antithetical to how we think about tournament golf at an individual level. Because match play, at its core, is about pressure. It's about creating constant pressure on your opponent. And that constant pressure is applied from the start of the hole. You don't work backwards. Putting is not as important, even though lots of fans like to go, well, we don't make anything. We didn't putt well. It's not about putting. Match play is not about putting. Match play is about pressure. And you apply pressure with great tee shots and great approach shots. That's why the best players, statistically, at the Ryder Cup were the best ball strikers. The best ball strikers. The best ball strikers didn't putt well. They actually putted, lost strokes putting. But because they put so much pressure on tee to green, they were successful. Because it turns out making putts gets a whole lot more difficult when you have to make it. One after another after another. And you don't have 72 holes or 18 holes to bail you out. You don't have more holes. Can't just be one of many. It's one now or you lose. Or you win. It's harder to make. So, from a perspective of the American team, and frankly the European team, men's and women's, what you want for your team is ball strikers. You want players who hit great iron shots, who hit great long tee shots, fairly straight, to get it in play. That's what develops a winning team. All right, we're going to take a break, come back, talk about the trip to Europe and kind of takeaways from all that time over in Spain and Germany and Italy right after this. All right, welcome back, everybody. Appreciate you tuning in this week. We're going to talk a little bit about the journey to Europe, and then we'll wrap up the show this week with our conversation from earlier this morning with Peter Jacobson, the chairman of the World Champions Cup. So this was an incredible journey, a really cool trip, and I want to work back from the end kind of in a way. So as I mentioned earlier, my wife and I flew over from out of Dulles on Wednesday evening, got to Spain, got to Madrid Thursday morning, and we got out right away. And then that was September 20th, and on October 1st, we flew home in the morning. Didn't, you know, we took a cab from our place in Italy and in Rome and went right to the airport. But the night prior, we went to a cathedral not too far from our place. Roman Catholic. I'm not particularly religious. I'm not the best churchgoer. Kids go to Catholic school, but I'm not inherently more religious than the average person. And we went to this church, a cathedral, and it was at night. So they had had mass earlier, Saturday night mass, and then they'd opened it up and the lights had been dimmed, and you know, each little chapel in the cathedral had its own little lighting set up, and the ceiling of the cathedral had been painted, and they had this mirror in kind of the very obvious walkway, and you could look at the mirror instead of having to look up, crane your neck, you could just look in the mirror and see the incredible painting. And then you could drop in a euro coin and it would light up the roof, you know, the painting, so you could see it. And as we were walking around the chapel and the kind of ambient music playing, I couldn't help but just feel this overwhelming sense of gratitude about a lot of different things. This trip, this opportunity to be able to do this, I don't know how many times, if again, I'll be able to do something quite like this. And I said that last year after going to the U.S. Senior Women's Am with my wife and kids to Alaska. So back-to-back years of once-in-a-lifetime kind of trips, or at least that's how I perceive them. And just a great sense of gratitude for those two things, for what we got to experience in Rome, for life. Just to be able to have that opportunity is something I was not bawling, but wiping away tears. And my wife probably didn't understand why. I didn't explain it to her. And I think that's what I have long felt about golf. And I've talked about it here on the show. Just the amount of gratitude that I have to be able to do what I do for a living. And it's a tremendous amount of work and all that stuff. And we're working on our next project. I've not really told many people about this, but we're starting to tell people. The next thing coming for Golf Newsnet is a 24/7 TV channel. And that'll be available starting probably in December or January. Maybe a little sooner, but December or January. is our target time frame on streaming services. We're starting to sign contracts and get all that stuff worked out and get broadcast rights, and we're working out potentially airing live golf tournaments for major tours on our channel and all this. I'm super excited about it. And all of that is a lot of work. It's a lot. It's a big endeavor, what Golf News Net has become. But yet still, I do it every single day because it creates the opportunity to be able to say, I do want to go do this for 10 or 12 days with my wife. And that it's somehow sort of work. It is work. And to get to do what I love. And sitting in a media center is not what I love, admittedly. I try to spend as little time in media centers as possible because I, for a variety of reasons, sitting in a media center watching golf sounds like a terrible way to experience a golf tournament, especially like the Solheim Cup and Ryder Cup. I was there to see golf. I want to watch golf. Also, my wife was there. I didn't want to just leave her out there. and doing everything with the radio and now TV coming along and the website, just going to a golf tournament and watching golf for 4 days is not particularly conducive to what I do for a living. It's not particularly good for my business model. So to be able to take a week and a half out and do that, and then knowing what's coming, just kind of made me particularly emotional. But I cannot speak highly enough of the experience that we had really everywhere that we went. Like I said, I'll work backwards. Rome was, man. We flew in on a Tuesday afternoon, flew from Munich. We were in Munich for 36 hours. We'll talk about that for Oktoberfest. But flew in, got a car driver to take us to our place. And whenever you go to someplace new, you might have heard of it. You might not have. You might have researched it heavily. You might not have. But you're always kind of discombobulated. You don't know what you're experiencing. You're just kind of going to where you got to go, and then you take the next step from there. And we were driven around the city, and we wind up going around this incredible museum, and we're not far from the Forum, and there's the Colosseum apparently behind some building that we hadn't seen yet. And we get to our place, and we're going through these incredibly narrow streets, and they just wind and wind. And that's something I love so much about Rome, that you were just a left turn away from something incredible. Right turn away, winding street away from something that was 2,000 years old or 5,000 years old or 400 years old that would just blow your mind. And we get to our place, and it's a 200, probably 50-year-old building, I don't know, with a spiral marble staircase with no inside railing. And I was rushing up the steps with all our bags. Like, I got to find this place. We've booked this place. It's like a kind of like a ghost hotel, sort of like borderline Airbnb, four rooms and a converted flat, you know, apartment. And we were worried that it wasn't even real, that we were going to get ghosted, and we wind up in the place. We have these keys that are they're hundreds of years old keys. I haven't used anything like that in forever, maybe ever in my entire life. And from that kind of holy smoke, what am I getting into experience, to falling in love with a city of just, and not the tourist. I mean, the tourist components were cool. We saw Trevi Fountain. The Pantheon was amazing, especially at night. Spanish Steps. Trastevere was a really cool neighborhood. We went over the bridges over the Tiber River. We saw the Vatican. We saw the Colosseum inside and out. We saw the Forum. We hit all those high points. Saw churches. All those things were amazing. But my favorite parts were walking around and just feeling the energy of a place. And walking around seeing goofballs singing karaoke at a posh bar. The people who are eating out al fresco at night, talking about their day. People who are from Rome just walking around with their families. The rush in and out of the metro station to go to the Ryder Cup. The Colosseum station is going to stick with me for a long time. It's the Colosseum station. You get out and you're like, all right, well, you know, Colosseum's probably not too far away. No, it's right there. It's 500 feet away. And you're looking straight at it. You walk out. Incredible. The architecture just blows you away if you're into that kind of thing. Just the angles and the ways that things old and less old are paired together. Flora and fauna, marble, concrete, cobblestone. It takes over your senses, and it makes it really easy to fall in love with that place. And by the end, you kind of started to get used to what that was like. You know, you kind of remembered the routes to get home from different places and what turns you had taken, which ones you hadn't taken. There was old, obviously older. I mean, we went to restaurants that have been around since the 1870s. We went to a sandwich shop that opened like a couple years ago. And tiramisu through the roof. Gelato, very good gelato, naturally. Great pasta dishes and pizza. Had a great lamb set of lamb chops. I mean, just the food was tremendous. We put in probably 90 miles of walking over the course of the vacation. And probably 55 of those were in Rome. Just could not get enough of walking around that city. So if you get the chance, do it. Do it the next time that you can. Flights aren't cheap this time of year because it's kind of the height of tourist season. But even if you went in February or March when it's like 60 degrees out instead of 85 degrees as it was for us. Oh man, I think Rome in cool weather would just, that would be great. We visited a city in Tuscany called Montepulciano. It's a city on the hill the Etruscans built, which I don't understand why everyone had to live on a hill. I understand why, but why so far up the hill? But nevertheless, it created an incredible place. It's truly a city on a huge up climb. Three different city walls from the 1100s, 1300s, 1500s. And just a place you would never, you'd never understand here in the United States. just a remarkable experience there as well. Learned a little Italian. Before that, we went to Oktoberfest in Munich. If you want more recommendation around that, happy to talk about that privately. But we flew Sunday, right around the end of the Solheim Cup from Malaga's airport to Munich. And that was the thing I was worried about the most, I think. Because I don't speak German. I speak Spanish pretty fluently. And still, that was overwhelming in a way. But because people in Spain speak Spanish at a speed I've never experienced compared to Costa Rica, Panama, and Mexico. But I didn't know the language. It's intimidating. There's this reputation that Germany is colder. Not weather, but just in terms of personality. It's just quieter. It's not colder. It's quieter. And took a train late night, trying to find your way around a train station that you've never been in, and foreign language and you don't even have any inkling of what the words mean. It was very difficult, but Oktoberfest was the best big booze carnival. Man, it was fun. My wife and I probably went around 10 in the morning, and we left around 8 at night, and probably went to 5 or 6 tents. I remember most of them. I don't remember all of them. But it's truly a carnival. I mean, they have a big Ferris wheel. They have carnival rides. The things like that take you up like 100 feet in the air and then drop you all of a sudden. Sounds like a terrible idea while you're drinking. But they had that, different games, different food. Every tent had different, slightly different beer, although with the purity laws, having four ingredients, more or less kind of the same, slightly different flavors. But the decoration was amazing. Just getting to sit with people in a crowded room and talk about where you were from and your shared experience or your different experience. We met so many Americans. We met people from Germany. Some Germans could speak English and talk to us. I sure as hell couldn't speak German and talk to them. So that was nice. Stood on tables and danced, sang songs, just had it all. I mean, it was so great. I don't think you could do it for more than 2 or 3 days, probably 2 days in a row when you'd have had enough. But that's what made a 36-hour journey to Germany so great. We just did it and got out of there and really enjoyed it. And then Malaga, I mean, we talked a little bit about it earlier in the show, but it was completely different than what I think I was expecting when I saw it on the map. But Malaga City was amazing. We took, again, another castle on a hill, a fortification on a hill in a big Mediterranean beach town. We climbed to the top of that. Then we got to the top and realized you could have taken a bus or a cab up the backside in like 5 minutes, but it was worth it just to see the incredible views of the city. And then to get to experience again a Picasso museum with all kinds of his work, incredible cathedral. It's a really cool Really cool town. Madrid, architecture, food, the plazas. Oh man, what a great cool place. We took a what's called a tuk-tuk tour around, kind of like a golf cart, but a three-wheel golf cart tour of the city, and just going around the winding streets, narrow streets. Not nearly as narrow, well, close to as narrow as Rome. Different architecture that kind of blows your mind. Just great views, great people. Really, really enjoyed it there. I really will relish the opportunity to go back there. And again, just kind of through it all, like trying to make the most of something you probably won't get to do again anytime soon. And I really wanted to do that. I feel that way about most any of these types of adventures that you think are probably going to be one-time deals, where you just got to get the most out of it as you can. And you might be tired and you might pass out at the end of every night. And then you get up at 6:30, 7 in the morning, you do it again. And you keep doing it till you can't do it, till you run out of days and you got to go home and get the most out of it. I'm not, I mean, I don't get me wrong, I love to kind of sit around every now and then, but that's not the way I live life. And to be able to just kind of go, 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 go. For those days was awesome, just truly awesome. And I will not miss the financial expense of that part of that, of traveling like that. And we didn't do anything particularly fancy accommodations wise. We did more or less the minimum, but I love that kind of stuff. And having been gone for the Ireland trip and this trip, basically 22 days of the last 30, that I've been away and in Europe somewhere. Now I'm kind of ready to get back to work a little bit, but I cannot get enough of those types of things, of doing those types of things. And I can't wait to be able to do it with my kids. That'll be the next set of journeys where we get to take my son to his bridge in Ireland, what he's named for. Where we can go try out different places. I kind of want to do Iceland next. I think it'd be a shorter journey and be a lot of fun. There's so much to see and do, and kind of at 40, starting to recognize I might not get to it all. But to pick and choose the high points and between these journeys, the last couple, year plus 14 months have been they've been the best. And then now I'm gonna well up thinking about them. But and some people don't care for travel. That they get their kicks different ways. And but whatever it is that gets you going, just having an overwhelming appreciation for it, I think, goes a long way. Makes it more special. Makes you want to do it all the more. Makes you want to bring it to more people in your life. So hopefully this wasn't just blabbering on about a trip for 15 minutes, but hopefully some form of connection that, whatever you love, having a great respect and appreciation for it. All right, we'll go ahead and take a break, and we'll be back with Peter Jacobson right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you here with us this week. Final segment this week is our interview. Peter Jacobson is the chairman of the World Champions Cup. It's a competition that will debut on the Champions Tour. It'll air on ESPN and ABC December 8th through 10th. It's a unique competition. It's featuring Champions Tour players, three different teams: Team USA, captained by Jim Furyk; Team Europe, captained by Darren Clark; and Team International, captained by Ernie Els. And they're starting to announce some of the players that are qualifying for each of those teams. We talked to Peter today about his role as chairman, about the coming together of this event, what it means for him to get it first presented this year in Florida at Concession, and then what he's thinking about for the future of the event. So enjoy this conversation with Peter Jacobson.
Thanks for hopping on. So, can you kind of give me an idea of how your involvement as chairman came together with World Champions Cup in the first place?
This is an event that my good friend Charlie Besser, who's the president of Intersport, Charlie and I've talked about this for 4 or 5 years. I was fortunate enough to be on two Ryder Cup teams for the US. And I loved my time with my 11 other teammates and my captain. I just loved that. And I've always thought that when I turn 50, I'm 69 now, so I won't be playing, but I wanted to see if we could put together a competition, much like the Ryder Cup, President's Cup, Solheim Cup, but involve all the players on the Champions Tour and the where they represent their countries. So we put this together, the U.S. versus Europe versus international. And because I couldn't play, Charlie so graciously asked me to be the chairman. So my role really has been behind the scenes, helping to keep the ball rolling with the players and the teams and the captains. And it's a role that I've really enjoyed. I've never been a Ryder Cup captain or a President's Cup captain or assistant captain, any of that. But this is kind of that role behind the scenes, working on behalf of both sides, the management and also the players.
How did your peers, how did PGA Tour Champions players feel when you got what was the reception of, hey, we're doing this. This is the idea, and it's really come to fruition.
Absolute excitement. I've been talking to Jim and Ernie and Darren about the captaincy for 2-3 years. And every time I saw them, they would say to me, hey, what's the status? Where are we? How are we doing? So it's been a long road, a tough road, but we are here. We're at the starting gate now, 60 days out. So we're very excited. And the players on the Champions Tour that know all about it, know they have a chance to play, they are excited. They talk about it. Obviously, we've got the Charles Schwab Cup year coming to an end. Steve Yep. Stricker is in complete control. But the players all want to be able to have a chance to play in the World Champions Cup and represent their country.
You guys are starting to kind of name players that are being a part of each competition. How were they approached, and what's kind of their expectation for the competition itself and their role in and in promoting it?
I think that's up to them. The captains are the ones that are in charge of the selection process. I'm involved as well from the chairman's position. But the players are all able to promote it as they wish or not promote it, however they want to approach it. That's our job. That's the organizing committee's job. And I will say that the captains, Ernie Els, Darren Clark, and Jim Furyk, have taken a major role in helping us to promote the event. Every time we've asked them to step forward to do a press conference or to do an interview, they've done it. So my whole goal on this was to make this the Champions Tour players' own event. This is, I think you hear a lot of the disgruntled players behind the scenes when they talk about the European Tour or the PGA of America, all those things kind of bubble under the surface. This is an event that I want the Champions Tour players to embrace and literally have it feel like it's their own.
Having a three-team lineup is obviously kind of brings together two different concepts, President's Cup, oh really, three Solheim and Ryder Cup. The nine-hole match concept really seems interesting to me. Is that as much around trying to just make sure it all kind of fits together logistically as it is also creating a different format for something people have kind of come to love, which is team match play?
Yeah, you got it. It's exactly right. When Charlie Besser and I put this together, I sat down one day with a big pad of paper and I thought, how can these three teams play together? And I scratched out a format to where it's going to be metal play. So if Ernie, Jim, and Darren play the first hole, and Ernie makes a three, Darren makes a four, and Jim makes a five, Ernie gets a point from Darren and he gets a point from Jim. So he walks off the first hole with 2 points for the international. Since Darren made four and Jim made five, he gets a point. So it's a round robin. International's playing Europe and international's playing USA, vice versa, all the way through. So there's all three teams competing. So each hole ideally is worth a point for each team should they win the match. And that way, everybody's going to play every hole. Nobody's going to walk in and lose a match 2-1 or 3-2. And I think it's going to be great for the fans because the fans will be able to watch nine holes instead of having to spread out over 18, which, as you know, can be a pretty good haul. And it's going to allow us to have unique best ball and Scotch foursome, where we'll have six players in one grouping.
Oh, cool.
And it's going to be fun. The players want to win. There's no question. This is not an exhibition, but speaking as a Champions Tour player, a former Champions Tour player, we all know each other. We've grown up in this game together. Furyk and Els and Clark, to name those three, they're like brothers from different mothers. They've played together in international competitions and individual major championships and tournaments for their 30 years. So they all know each other. They love each other. They appreciate each other, but they want to kick each other's ass. So it's going to be that friendly type of competition that you're going to see the fire.
Do you think there's any nuanced difference between how someone like Darren Clark and someone like Ernie Els sees captaining a team competition like this, because they have somewhat different experiences in captaining, being the President's Cup and Ryder Cup are their own things. They're slightly different.
Well, the one thing that I do know, when you're, again, I was never a captain or a vice captain, but in speaking with captains, they make it their own. I remember when Paul Azinger famously, when he put together his Navy SEAL pod system, mm-hmm. he made that his own, and he was very successful. Other captains have just kind of let things happen the way they happen. So I think you'd probably it might be an interesting study to check in with the captains from over the years, Watson and Lanny Watkins and Raymond Floyd and Hal Sutton for the U.S. and Darren Clark and Langer and Luke Donald from Europe and Ernie and Nick Price from international, how they approached it. I think it will be interesting for me to see how each captain prepares each team, because being the chairman, obviously I have an unbiased role, but I will be I'll be checking in on each of the teams, and my role will be as an advisor and hopefully a helping assistant to all three teams.
Last question for you. Obviously, sounds like a tremendous amount of work over several years went into just getting this thing off the ground the first time. But do you see a future in which the World Champions Cup travels around to Europe and to an international venue and kind of have a three-site rotation? Or do you kind of expect to see this in one location?
We've already had those discussions. We haven't even had our first tournament yet, but we've already had discussions about that. Our goal right now is to firmly plant this World Champions Cup flag into the ground and establish this as a team competition that is here to stay. And the Concession is a fantastic host. So yeah. I think once we're completed, once the tournament is over and the year is over, we'll be starting looking at next year, 2024. We will start looking at those plans and those opportunities, but yes, we've already had those conversations.
Well, Peter, thank you for taking the time to talk to me. I appreciate it. Congrats on everything World Champions Cup, and I'm looking forward to seeing it come December.
You got it, Ryan. Thank you.
Thanks so much to Peter for joining me. I appreciate it. It sounds like the event is going to be really enjoyable. It'll be a little bit of a different spin on some things that we've seen from other team competitions of relevance, and hopefully it all kind of comes together in a beautiful way in December. That's going to do it for us this week on the show. Thank you so much for your time. I know this is a little bit longer than usual episode, so I appreciate you spending some time with us today. And we'll be back next week with another show. We'll spend some time talking about the Korn Ferry Tour Championship and Epson Tour Championship. 40 cards between those two tours, the PGA Tour and LPGA Tour, are on the line. Some lives are going to change next week, this weekend. So very excited for that. Hopefully you'll get interested in that. The Alfred Dunhill Links Championship is this week on the DP World Tour, their version of the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, one of my favorite tournaments of the year. And then we've got the Sanderson Farms Championship on the PGA Tour as part of the FedEx Cup Fall. If you have any questions for me, you can get a hold of me via email, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. You can also find me on Twitter, X, Threads and Instagram at the handle Ryan Ballingy. Thanks so much for your time. We will talk to you next week on the 19th Hole Golf Show.